You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon, I'm Louis Sange, your host for Perspectives. And joining us today are two local professional photographers. Chad Perling and Steve Lama have been around teaching and doing photography on their own as professionals, doing it as a hobby. Photography in general, we're going to talk about that because this is a time of year specifically when we have graduations, we have different events going on, weddings, and sometimes, you know, you're just hoping that that picture would come out. Remember when you graduated from high school many years ago and you were going, well, I wonder if I hope that picture comes out, and you would be in anticipation waiting for them to return the film after it was developed, and then you'd anxiously look at the pictures and maybe 9 out of the 12 were bad. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Let's talk a little bit about photography. Tell us a little bit about, briefly, kind of how you've seen photography evolve and how it's changed since when you were kids and you guys had cameras that you fooled around with and mom and dad had to take the roll to get developed.
I can't remember that far back. I came to photography very, very late. I didn't do it till I was in college. I didn't do any of the yearbook or anything like that. I was in college and had to take a photo class because I was a communications major. And when I figured out how cool it was, I just went nuts with it. And by the way, I appreciate the introduction as us being professional photographers, but I believe both Steve and myself spend more of our time and income is on teaching in communications field, in particular photography, than it is shooting these days. Although,
but you're getting paid to,
during the summer, that switches back a little bit. So,
now you talked about the getting hooked on photography, and you know sometimes that's the way it was with me because I majored in radio and television production. I was a behind the scenes guy. I wanted to learn how to direct, how to produce, how to do all that stuff. And my senior year, I took a TV news class, and I got hooked. And so that's the way it ended up. So what happened? What opened up the door for you or window, whatever, that made you get interested in photography?
Well, I saw there was the photo class I had to take. And so I borrowed a book from somebody to look at it before I took the class, well before I took the class. And I was just fascinated by all the controls and stuff that cameras had that I didn't realize because I, like a lot of people, was just a point-and-shooter. So it was just kind of a technical aspect that got me first, and then the artistic side of photography, you know, picks up after that pretty quickly. And I just was fascinated with all the controls you could have over your image and thought I could tell stories that well as I could write. So that's what did it.
To me, it was always the craft, kind of the movie-making magic behind the scenes, how you'd make something float and that technical side. And so I got drawn into it because of the technical aspect of it. Not really the art side, but more the science side. That's why I went on to Brooks, because I liked the science side of photography. It's changed a lot over the years because, you know, you used to really have to know what you're doing with your equipment and be able to pre-visualize because you didn't have that instant feedback that we all have today on the digital cameras. So you had to know what you're doing because, you know, you're photographing a groundbreaking or a ribbon cutting or a portrait of somebody, and then they're gone. You know, they've left town or the event is over, and if you didn't get it right. So you really had to know the craft, and that made it rewarding from the standpoint that when you could pre-visualize and then you could use the controls to get it the way you wanted it, and then you got those results back from the lab. That part was the challenge and what really I thought was interesting about the whole craft.
I'm glad that you mentioned science because recently we had a chef on. We were discussing actually the fact that being a chef is kind of like chemistry. And so people don't realize that when they're doing things, they're actually using science or physics or chemistry, etc. So could you explain to us in layman terms kind of a little bit about the science of photography that,
well,
that interested you?
Well, just to start, and it's the way I introduce photography in my classes when I teach photography is I just take the word photography. It's a compound of photo and graphy, which deals with light and drawing. So you're drawing with light. And when you have no light, you can't have photography. So using the camera's controls of apertures and shutter speeds, which control how much light enter the camera and reach the chip or the film in those days, and how you balance those two elements to then get a good exposure, along with the creative controls that those two create within the picture of depth of field or motion or movement. And so it's that balancing act of combining those components together. And as the lighting changes, bright daylight, overcast, shadows, indoors, outdoors, you have to make the various adjustments in order to take the picture and have good results.
As far as what you just said, you know, nowadays we can just say, okay, quick, hold it, and you can press the shutter as often as you want. And back in the old days, I like to talk a lot about Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. And the Civil War, they took millions of pictures, but thousands of them were lost because people didn't want to see them anymore. They were tired of the war. And because they used plate glasses back then, a lot of them were bought by people who own greenhouses. And so it's sad to hear that, you know, or see that all these wonderful pictures of the, I don't want to say wonderful in the fact that wonderful, but historic pictures of the Civil War were put on greenhouses and they just faded away. And in fact, I think Matthew Brady went bankrupt because, you know, that was his living.
Yeah, he also had he was big on a portrait studio and ended up financially broke, I think, by the time he passed away. He's kind of interesting character, too. He didn't take as many pictures as we had given him credit for in the past. He had a slew of photographers working for him, but he always put his name on their work and paid them very little. It is kind of interesting. Also,
that happens today in some instances.
Yeah, it does.
Not know, just in photography.
In the art world more.
Yes.
Than
uh-huh.
Most places, kind of interesting.
Now, what about, because we talk, you know, some people will look at pictures from the Civil War or from the Old West. In fact, even some pictures I've ever had Lincoln, and the fact that they don't smile, they're very stiff. Is that the fact that because it took so long to take a picture?
Yes. The exposure times, how long somebody had to expose a plate, around Civil War time was several seconds. Before that, it was minutes. So they used to sit you in a chair with a couple of pads on the back of your head that you would lean against, and you would just have to hold still. Well, it was much harder to hold a smile for a long time. So they just wanted your face to be as relaxed as possible so you could do a 30-second exposure and still get a sharp image.
And this may sound a little bit cabra, but I read an article in one of the newspapers several years ago. It was a British paper that they discovered some pictures in an article that people used to take pictures of their loved ones who had passed away. I mean, not in the coffin, but they would sit mom or the baby or whatever, you know, and have a group picture so that they could remember.
Yeah, I remember running across that once, but I didn't get into it a whole lot. It's quite a difference between then and now when they have cameras that have a smile detector on it and it won't take a picture until it sees you smile.
It's really interesting when Chad and I are doing different workshops and classes and students will bring in different models. And what I always like to tell my class is the buttons are there. The controls are the same. It's just you got to know which button to get into which menu to do which function to change this setting. And that's the complexity that's been created now with digital.
Yeah, it's incredible what they've done.
You know, it used to be you'd have a Pentax K1000 or you'd have some other old film camera and it had two controls, aperture and shutter speed. You know, and if you focus the lens and you set the two controls correctly, you know, that was pretty much it. But now it's menu after feature, and it's kind of weird to look at these, and you're wanting to take a picture, and it won't. And then as soon as they smile, it takes it. You're like, wow.
It's interesting, as you mentioned, the fact that you have to be ready because they're not going to reenact something, especially if it's a news event. However, I find it incredible that when President Kennedy was assassinated, we don't have one single shot. It was a photographer, a professional photographer. The Zapruder film, he was a tailor who got – we didn't see the film, I think, for 25 years before it went on the air. And 12 seconds, 16 seconds, and that's the only professional photograph we had.
Yeah, there are no real still images of that.
Except for the
moment.
Killing of Oswald.
Yeah, yeah, that one there were photographers for.
Now, when you're doing that and when you're out there, Chad, as a photojournalist, and because I've seen you at games, I've seen you covering different events, What is it that is going through your mind? What you want to get the shot that's different than everybody else, correct?
Yeah, first of all, I just want to make – if it's a breaking event, I just want to make sure I get a good picture first. I can simplify that. If it's a basketball game, I know sitting near the – underneath the basket is going to get me, you know, what I call a nostril or armpit shot, and I'm going to get a good one. As soon as I think I have one of those, then I'm looking elsewhere to get something that's a little different. At a news event, it's to get that scene first, and then I start looking for that something different. Because if I look for the something different first, I may miss the overall shot. So my thought is, one, how can I tell the story? And in photojournalism, it tended to be one picture. That's what you got. You got one picture. That's what you had to think about. Now, you shot a lot more than that, but you did one picture. Now, actually, photojournalists, as few as there are left of us, they get to shoot. They get to put a lot on because newspapers use the internet more, so you can put a series of photos there. But in the newspaper, it's still in the printed paper. It's just that one shot has to tell the story. So it's a matter of, you know, what's happening in front of you, how quickly can you see it, and getting a different perspective kind of depends. I didn't work at any really large newspapers, so I might be a solo guy there. Every now and then there was a fire where two or three photographers might show up, and I didn't worry too much about trying to get a better shot than somebody else. That would always be measured after the fact. I just thought, what's the best one that gets me a scene of this fire or a death, as it happened to be a couple times in me, those really moments that you never forget. You know, your first dead body when you go to a scene where there's been an accident of some sort.
People are very visual, and of course when something happens like 9/11, we remember that, or where were you when Kennedy was shot, the landing on the moon, it is the anniversary is next month. And one of the things that people love is looking at pictures, and some people, critics, have said that that's why Life magazine was so popular in the 60s, because of their pictures.
Yes, both Life and Look were dedicated to the photo story, the photo essay. They were fantastic. I have copies of several copies of the old Life magazine. But it just, those were the boom times for visual imaging. Now it gets diluted a bit just because it's so easy for anybody to take a picture, and almost everybody that has a cell phone has a camera built into it. And so that's diluted a bit, although it's still out there. It's everywhere. But it dilutes from that professional image. Although, you know, without them, there's lots of things we wouldn't have seen, including, you know, the Boston Marathon pictures, the first ones we saw were from amateurs with cell phones, basically.
I'm glad that you brought that up, and we'll talk a little bit more about amateurs in a bit. But Steve was talking science and cameras earlier, and the fact that technology has changed everything as well. With Photoshop and other software like that, you can turn a picture into just about anything. And if you're not an expert, you really can't tell if the picture is Photoshopped unless you know it well. So how do you know nowadays, okay, if this is a real picture? Obviously, you know, a lot of those pictures that you see in National Enquirer are kind of like, I wonder. But you see a lot of those pictures in social media.
It's pretty hard to distinguish immediately when you look at a picture whether or not it's Photoshopped. As a photographer, I think both Steve and I are very critical of seeing something. We were just in Ruidoso doing some kind of workshop seminar things, and Steve was talking about a television scene, I think, where the lighting was
different. When they're, you know, they have a dialogue sequence in the film, and, you know, they do the cross cut back and forth, and they don't pay attention to the lighting as they're filming, you know, each person individually and then the wide shot. But sometimes you can spot, you know, bad Photoshop work, but more often than not, the skills that people have today and the time they're spending in front of the computer, you know, it's great. I'm more of the opinion that I like to try and encourage people to get the picture first when they take it. I don't like to spend a lot of time at home on the computer editing and re-editing. And I think that's one's own choice, what they choose. A lot of people, they pre-visualize a very complex photograph as a final image, and then they go gather the parts, and then they combine it to create this photo montage or photo illustration in the computer. And that's great. It's a great tool that people now have that we didn't have not that long ago.
So it's almost like either painting a picture, a portrait, or paint by number.
Yes.
How many of us remember the postcards of the farmer that has the pumpkin that was the entire bed of his truck?
Well, that was jackalope.
That was done in dark room, dodging, burning, masking. But more people looked at that as like, ooh, that's neat. But for some reason, when we do that now on the computer, it's like, oh, it's been manipulated.
Yeah.
But there's been manipulated photos forever.
It's just much, much easier today. I mean, much easier. That's probably a bigger change than what's happened in the camera itself is the post-processing, the whole Photoshop idea.
Would you say that it's pretty easy for anybody to pick up a camera and be able to take pictures?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Because they're idiot-proof, I guess, if it's the word. I don't want to offend anybody. But, I mean, you know, I'm like Steve. When you see sometimes
it is. There were always point-and-shoot cameras, but the thing they can do now on top of that is look at the back of the camera and see that their picture came out or didn't.
Well, and the other component that we now have to think about with this discussion is, you know, we used to have the film cameras. We had the point-and-shoot cameras, which were small pocket compact-type cameras. But nowadays, our cell phones have resolution that rivals a lot of those early compact cameras, along with the ability to not only take the picture – edit it on the fly, and then upload it and send it out, and you're instantly pushing out images to the world instantaneously. And now we start having this flood of images that everyone's creating. And it's a great tool. It's, you know, there's a lot of people that have done great work with it, but it's a tool that now so many of us have that we didn't have that many years ago.
But let's talk about, I guess it's like Dennis and I were talking the other day about the fact that when we started broadcasting, you had to take a test. You had to get a license to broadcast. And now just about anybody can go on. And there are people at home are probably going, yeah, well, you're on the air. Well, but I had a license. So I had to take that. Now, as far as shooting the pictures and taking those pictures that you talked about, anybody can pick them up, the cameras. But still, there are some people who prefer those cameras that you can just throw in the box and get developed, the throwaway cameras.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. By the way, if I can take one step back in case anybody wants to do any looking at this on their own, is to Google or do a web search for fake news photos, or in particular Reuters, Reuters, fake photos. And the reason I say that is because you'll see some photo manipulation used. The first big, big case was this Reuters photographer who was manipulating a lot of his war photography from the Middle East. They ended up throwing away over 300 of his photographs. Of course, they fired him, and then they had to start running stories on, you know, what he did. He should have taken my Photoshop class. I could have saved him his job, maybe, because he did a pretty bad job sometimes.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, and I oftentimes will in discussions point out that we sometimes will make an assumption a photo has been manipulated or not. But in news, we should have the understanding that that's likely to not have been manipulated, altered, or anything because it's news.
Yeah, we certainly hope so.
Outside of news, I tend to err more on the side of it's been manipulated. And it could be simple adjustments, but it could actually be mass composites of multiple images. But there's been some work done to it in most cases. Again, most, not all. There's some that's very straightforward, and it's, you know, what they call straight photography. But I'm going to regress quickly, too. Chad was talking about basketball games. Aside from the skills and the technical craft, it's knowing what you're photographing. You can have all the skills in terms of the technology and the science, but if you don't know the basics of the football game or the basketball game or fill in that blank.
Good point.
You know, you have to know what it is you're photographing. And so you've got to reach that balance where you know how to control the equipment, you know how to manipulate the settings to get the results you want, but you also have to know where to be to get that right shot.
What about, and this is something that you and I talk a lot about, Steve, because we're big advocates of this. And Chad, you mentioned the fact also that people can take pictures now and put them on social media, Facebook. The problem, and this is, again, what you and I have a problem with, Steve, sometimes is copyright and the fact that someone will take a picture and they'll put it up there and it's not their picture, or else they'll fix it or change it. And again, it's not their picture, but it's stealing. It's piracy, you know.
And it's,
and I know nobody here has ever downloaded an illegal song.
Yeah.
It's something that it's, you know, we get on this idea that you get it off the web, and it's not. It's not an open range of just being able to take that content. And so it's a balance. You know, you see this often. How many times have you gone to YouTube and you go back to a video that you were watching and it's been removed because it didn't follow certain guidelines?
So if you guys post a picture, do you have to go through the extra trouble of saying that it's copyrighted or it's patented or anything like that? Or do you have your own webpage?
I haven't put anything new on my website in forever, but I'm thinking about updating it. Steve takes care of my website for me. So
he's good.
I just have to give it to him. Is putting a copyright symbol on top of it, if, you know, not faded, but so that it's obvious enough that somebody couldn't take it and go make a print.
And can you still – well, I guess you can put watermarks on the –
Yeah, that's
something.
What I meant is okay. A watermark, yeah, a digital okay. Watermark with a big C, circle C on it. Put my name below that. It's real easy to do in Photoshop and other photo programs now, so that's the way I'm going to do it from now on.
If we've hit somebody's button where they – I got the photo bug now and what would you recommend for someone who is just starting out? What kind of camera to get? Because when they look at pixels, they look at, you know, the size of the camera, price. What should they look for?
Yeah.
Starting.
Megapixels is kind of an interesting thing because it's probably the first thing you see listed in an ad, you know, for a store. You've got this many megapixels. Anything above 12 megapixels on a point-shoot camera, as far as I'm concerned, is a waste. It's just a cell technique. You can actually get much better imaging if you had fewer megapixels. And to explain the science behind that is not worth it, but it's there. I don't know, since we're on public radio, whether or not I should mention particular camera companies or not, but the two that are kind of leading the point-and-shoot are Canon and Panasonic Lumix series of cameras. Now, there are lots of others out there, and they can vary a great deal. And there's some, you know, good cameras and bad. I wouldn't always go with the cheapest, but I wouldn't plan on spending, for a very decent point-and-shoot camera, more than between $150 and $200. You can get some very, very nice cameras. Other than that, stick to a brand you need, or type in camera reviews and take a look. There's lots of places that will give you very, very good reviews. You don't want just a person who's saying, wow, I bought this. It's wonderful. I don't care about users praising or not praising their cameras. But places like DP Review and SLR Gear and several others test cameras, and they test them against each other. And they actually take pictures with them, including studio shots that you can compare back and forth on your own. It's a good way to find out about cameras.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I always tell people when they ask me that question, the best camera is the one you'll use. So it doesn't matter what make, model, brand, resolution, if you'll use the camera. And with the new cameras, and as I mentioned earlier, the layout of the buttons and the menus, you might find the best reviewed camera, but either you don't like the ergonomics for your, you know, I like a larger camera. Some people like a smaller camera. You know, you may want to buy a camera, and I look at buying a camera like buying an automobile. What do you want to use it for? And if it's someone who's going to take a vacation and they want to have this little small pocket camera to drop in their pocket because they'll carry it with them, nowadays that would be your phone.
And take pictures with it.
And take pictures. You're going to be taking a cruise, and you're going to be photographing wildlife that's off the boat, you're going to need a longer lens. So that camera could be a different one. So I think the mistake people make is they are too quick to run out and just buy a camera because someone said this is the one to buy. You really have to think, what is it you want to achieve with your cameras, your photography, and then find the best fit.
Yeah. I had a lady who had taken a continuing education class with me and was going to go on an African safari. So just like Steve said, I got her one of this Super Zoom, just a hand-holdable point shoot, and she thought she may need a big DSLR. I said, you won't be able to afford the lens that'll, you know, take that lion. So we got her a Super Zoom. When she got back, she just loved it. It worked great for her. It cost her a few extra bucks to buy that type. There's one other thing you can do is just write me a blank check and make sure I get it, and I'll send you a camera within a week.
And he'll even
take good pictures for you.
You'll show up and teach him.
I'll even teach him a little.
Yeah. I may send you one because you were talking about basketball, and it'll bounce right back up to you.
Yes. The other thing, regardless of what camera, the other question people will oftentimes ask is, what resolution should I set my camera to? You should always set it to the highest resolution your camera has.
Yes.
You can always edit the photo later. You can't blow. You can. There's limited programs, but in a general rule of thumb, you can't enlarge photos without losing quality. So you always want to have the highest resolution, the largest file size. Yes, it will take up memory. Get a couple extra memory cards, but use the highest resolution, the best settings that the camera has. So if that's the rate limiting factor, maybe that might be your decision point, because you can't decide between model A or B. Go with the one that has the higher resolution.
Steve has a good rule too, is that, which I kind of forget to tell people about. He says, any accessories to that camera you think you need or want, buy them when you buy the camera. Buy an extra battery, an extra memory card. Could even be a case or an attachment lens that comes with it.
Lens
because
hoods.
The models turn over so quickly these days that they become archaic. So you want to have some backup to that. And I think that's a good idea. Steve's always telling people that.
What about the people who still have pictures in albums or in shoeboxes? And should people put them on CDs? Should they put them on drives? What do you recommend that they do with some of those pictures?
It is. And the jury's still out on longevity and archival. The rule of thumb that I've kind of come together through reading and following other blogs and so forth, burn, we still use the term burn. Archive it to a DVD. CDs and DVDs are the exact same thing. They're just space difference. DVD has a higher capacity. I never use rewritables. So I archive everything to a DVD. And if you really want to ensure that those images stay intact, every 5-6 years, you should remaster those to a new DVD, because in time, technology changes and how those DVDs are written and the hardware and software that creates those DVDs eventually changes. And I personally have some discs that I can't read any longer because they were burned a long time ago.
Or home VHSs.
Right. So,
yeah, but hit that shutter button.
You know, some people will archive to a hard drive and then just put that in a foil. But
I was going to say, every time I shoot something, it's put onto a DVD or CD, depends size of the project I did. It's also put on a hard drive, separate from my computer's hard drive, but a standalone hard drive. And the third thing I know that a lot of people are doing in colleges and universities do this to archive stuff is they archive their stuff on the cloud. I know that UTEP, for instance, and UT Austin and Northern Arizona, I believe, they archive each other's stuff so that – and they have a cooperative to do that. And a lot of colleges and universities are doing that. So it's always somewhere, even if it gets destroyed somewhere else.
I said foil, but I meant one of those static bags. That keeps static bag.
Well, we want to thank you all very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Chad Perling and Steve Lama, talking a little bit about photography. And if you're interested in finding out more about how to use Photoshop, how to be a better photographer, there are classes offered through the continuing education program, also through OLLI, and then, of course, here on campus and at El Paso Community College. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Perspectives is chamed to produce at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sainz.